Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
We're still talking with Barry Ritholtz because we couldn't stop.
The first ever double episode or double album of this podcast.
And who's Barry Ritholtz if you've just joined?
He runs Ritholtz Wealth Management. It's an advisor, heavy ETF user, and also a Bloomberg opinion columnist. And
a fellow podcast host.
Yeah, and big guy on Twitter. You know, a lot of people know this guy.
He's phenomenal. And we were so fascinated by him. We just kept going. You left. You had to walk away.
I know. I had a hard stop,
hard
as you
stop.
Like to say. That's your favorite term. And I had to go, but Barry was just in – he wasn't done, you could tell. And
no.
So you took one for the team. You stayed with him and talked for another 45 minutes.
It was longer. We had to edit it down. And, you know, the best part about talking with Barry is just that he's a fabulous interview and interviewer. So that was – we just kept – it was like we brought out a couch. And he laid down on the couch and we just kept going.
Yeah, you could tell talking to him that he's thought about most everything.
So here's the sequel. Use Your Disillusion 2 with Barry Ritholtz. So you've done 200 plus interviews for Masters of Business. What do you think are the things that you've really learned? The things that made you go, aha. What are those?
There's a handful of things that continue to surprise me. And I think at this point, I'm a pretty good read at when people are just BSing for spin. So first, the role of luck in successful people's lives. This isn't false humility. This is when you have people like Leon Cooperman and Howard Marks and Ray Dalio say, you know, It helps to be smart, but you got to get lucky. I've heard that over and over and over again from people.
But how do you think people get lucky?
Well, there's an old line about luck is where preparation meets opportunity, and there's a lot of that that's absolutely true. And I think if you're born to middle-class parents in the United States in the latter half post-war era, you're lucky. You're ahead. Guess what? You were born on third base. You're ahead of 80 or maybe 90% of the rest of the world's population. I was born in Brooklyn. I lived outside, either in New York or outside of New York my whole life. That's a huge bit of luck for me, and somehow I wander into finance. That's tremendously lucky. When Ray Dalio talks about that, I'm just going down the list. When Cliff Asness talks about serendipity, when people like that say, hey, you know I did well in school, but sometimes there's just fortuity. I don't know how you make yourself lucky, but when Nobel laureates say that, when Richard Thaler or Danny Kahneman or Robert Shiller says it helps to be lucky, you don't dismiss. So that's one thing. The second thing is how many people are willing to say, I was wrong. I got this wrong, and I realized I had to make a change. Otherwise, I was in trouble. The ability to be have some humility and put your ego aside and recognize the real world is another theme that comes up over and over again. I'm impressed how often, and I've added that as a standard question on the podcast. Hey, tell us about a time you failed and what you learned from it.
I'm going to flip it on you.
Oh, God. I have a lot of failures. I tend to be dismissive of people. I sometimes get frustrated when I'm trying to explain something that's obvious to me. How do you not understand this? Mark Andreessen, I'm dropping names left and right.
Keep going.
Mark Andreessen tells a story that their favorite investors are the guys who they're like peppering with questions. And these guys are getting frustrated. Hey, man, you're supposed to be smart. You're Mark fucking Andreessen. How do you not understand this? He tells that story. Like, you could see these guys are just, they've thought it out so well, and it's such a deep part of who they are. They're frustrated that the venture capitalist doesn't get it. And he tells a story. It's very charming. He speaks even faster than I do. I love that story because I totally relate to that. And sometimes I'm frustrated. This is obvious. How do you not get that? So that's a really terrible personal habit. I think that's a big failure. that I've been working on. There have been decisions I've made over the years that I look back and I just, oh my God, how did I make that decision? That was so terrible. I think a strength is your ability to recognize error and reverse yourself. So I'm pretty agnostic as much as this room can barely contain my oversized sense of self. I am very comfortable admitting error and saying we have to fix this. This is a mistake. There are a bunch of errors that are just way too embarrassing to even bring up. But trust me when I say I've made lots of errors. I've made lots of failures. My favorite part about failing is new ones. Like, I try not to repeat the same errors. All right, we've done that. Let's make a different mistake and see what we can learn from that. I think that's a healthy philosophy.
What's a challenge that you're wrestling with right now?
That's an interesting question. So anytime you're looking at the future, anytime you're trying to figure out what you want to be and what your company wants to be, you're kind of projecting and extrapolating out. But really, beyond a quarter or two, everything gets really, really fuzzy. And so you don't know what the economy is going to do. You don't know what the market is going to do. You don't know what sort of scandal is going to come along that either helps or hurts your underlying business or news event or whatever. And so I'm wrestling with – so we've been growing really rapidly. We started with five people and $90 million. It's now 10x on the assets and 5x on the people. And I wonder, at what point do we like have to throttle back? I did an interview with Ken Fisher, who's a fascinating guy, runs $100 billion, probably the most successful RIA in the country. And our firm is also an RIA. When Eric says you're an advisor, I interpret that as you manage a registered investment advisory. So when we... when I had a conversation with him, he's like, you guys are about to be $1 billion. You're about to be 5 years old. Suddenly, everybody who has those restrictions, they come off and there's a different group of people who are waiting in the wings to talk to you but have been unable to by their own bylaws. What are you talking about, Ken? I know of no such thing like that. So I hope he's right, but that's going to be an interesting challenge when we get to that. So
is that like an imaginary pool of water that you just kind of like eventually wade into?
You know, institutional is a very different business than high net worth and families and or even, you know, modest net worth on the robo side, on the liftoff is our automated investor. It's a very different arc of conversation. When most people come to us, they know who I am. They know Josh. They know Ben. You know, it's always one of the guys in the office was telling a story that they're speaking to somebody and the person says, you know, I was reading Batnick the other day. And it's like, wait, we call him Batnick. How the hell are you calling him Batnick? So that's a very different interaction than writing up responding to an RFP for an investing statement and what does the portfolio look like and what does the cost structure look like and blah, blah. So I think that's a really interesting side of the business that I don't want to say we've neglected. We just haven't focused our attentions on it because we've been busy mm-hmm. with everything else. I'm kind of fascinated by that and somewhat concerned. Hey, is this something we could bite off? Do we have the skill set? Do we have the personnel? Do we have the intellectual chops to play in those waters? I think we do or can easily shore them up with one or two hires. But to me, if Eric is right about, hey, is this active to passive transition taking place on the institutional side, I think it is. And whether we can swim in that pond, time will tell. But that's something I'm really thinking about and kind of fascinated by.
What do you think you need to swim in it?
I think you need a multi-year GIPS track record. I think you need a number of, I hate the word products, but a number of institutionally focused products that are more than simply plain Jane indices. We never want to try and sell performance to people because then I think that's the worst side of the business because you look at the churn rate at a lot of active shops, and I don't mean giant active shops. I mean any decent well-regarded shop with a relatively good track record, that is the least sticky money. That money moves. I'll give you a perfect example. I won't mention the name because I don't want to embarrass anybody because I think they're right. Also, that's why I don't want to embarrass them. So value has significantly underperformed growth for most of the past decade. Value typically goes through these long periods of time where it underperforms growth. But over,
and yet, when you look at it
over longer periods of time, value actually significantly outperforms growth, not by a small margin, by a nice chunk of performance. So if you're a value shop with a great long-term track record and your past 5 years, you've lagged by a percent or three, I'm amazed how money flies out of there. And when you see these outflows, you know, that's the net outflow. You're not seeing the full churn. A lot of these firms are adding $10 billion as they lose $11 billion. So they're seeing $1 billion in outflows, but really it's a multiple of that because of that churn rate. And I'm just astonished at, you know, what have you done for me lately seems to be the institutional active theme. And what a surprise that there's a move to passive because, Wes Gray at Alpha Architect wrote a wonderful piece. I think Jack Vogel or one of his other guys was on this. Even God would get fired as an active manager. Because God, with a perfect knowledge and omniscience of what various factors, what various attributes of a portfolio are going to outperform, still means you go through an occasional downdraft. When you look at Amazon and Netflix and Apple, all of them have suffered, and Google for that matter, 80% drawdowns multiple times in their history. So it doesn't matter how good a manager you are, if you're long Apple, if you're long Google, if you're long Netflix, and it's down 80%, your clients are screaming at you, despite the fact that, hey, I'm omniscient. I'm telling you, Apple is going to be the biggest market cap in the world. Google is going to be right behind it. Netflix, Flix, and Amazon are going to grow 10,000%. Just ride it out. You're fired.
Would you pick that guy up?
Who, God, as a portfolio manager?
Yeah.
As long as we get a fair fee negotiation, I'll put him on staff.
What's that top line of his resume look like?
It just says God. It's one word. Resume. God.
At God.
Do you really need more than that?
Here it is.
Created the heavens and the earth, blah, blah. No, you don't need it. Hey, what's this little thing about the flood? Can we have a conversation?
Is there
about
a fine print on that one?
I don't think so. But
it's called the Bible. So another kind of meta question for you. When you look at what you do, how you use ETFs, how you manage people's money, what do you think could disrupt you?
Well, you know, there's an inevitable market crash out there. It's somewhere off in the future. And hopefully the day before we don't say something like, I don't see a market crash coming for years and let's we're going to introduce leverage and options. We want everybody fully taking advantage. So other than like an unforced, really stupid error like that, the next recession is going to be a challenge. Trump is continually a challenge. Not just because our clients are left of center or right of center or whatever. It's just a random element that people have a hard time dealing with. I am constantly having the argument that you have to separate the hand-waving noise, the all-cap tweets, anything that doesn't impact discounted cash flow, profits, and revenue, you have to ignore. So, no, we're not going to war with Iran. That's a Russia distraction. No, we're not. He's not. Well, if he fires Mueller or not, he'll have to deal with the repercussions of it. But none of that impacts profits. Trade war and tariffs, even though we've been told they're easy to win, it turns out that may not actually be true.
And we're already seeing what
and
it looks like, right?
My worst case scenario is, and I'm on record saying, ignore the president until he does something really stupid because most of this is noise that doesn't matter. This is the first, the camel's nose under the tent. This is the first entry to, all right, you've said and done a number of things that are sort of shocking and unprecedented. Let's just say it's not business as usual in D.C. because you're draining the swamp and all that other fun stuff. This is the first thing that you look at. Even the tax cuts, which every analysis of them have said, this is not a well-crafted tax reform. But hey, it's a couple of trillion dollars. And by the way, clients hate when I say this. I know you may not be the biggest fan of, especially if you live in a blue state and you lost your state and local taxes. So we have a lot of clients in California and New York and Oregon and Connecticut. We don't, you know, people in Texas and people in Florida, they don't have to worry about that. But it's still a couple of trillion dollars. And yeah, it's bad for the deficit, blah, blah, blah. But give me $1 trillion, I'll throw you a hell of a party, someone much smarter than me once said. This is the first thing that this administration has done that you could see the immediate effect in the economic data. We're starting to see the push through for inflation, and that could lead to a series of dominoes that has a very negative consequence for the stock market.
Can we talk more about that? Inflation, like,
sure.
I mean, that has been such a theme for so long. Like, I mean, that's basically what hedge funds have lost their
low inflation, their longer on. For long, lower for longer has been. And, I've been in that camp,
and yet, you know, as interest rates start to inch up a little bit, mm-hmm. we start to maybe enter a world where that debt that we're all looking at gets a lot more expensive because of inflation.
Sure, that's a big issue.
So, although
I don't think it's the apocalyptic issue that the faux deficit hawks have pretended.
But so play this out with me. Like, what? How much longer can it stay low, and what does that end game look like for us as investors?
So, to me, the biggest two variables in inflation are commodities, highly dependent on the dollar, and wages. We've started to see wages tick up on the endpoints of the wage distribution curve. So, we've seen a number of states and cities raise the minimum wage. That's ticked up. If you're a Walmart, a Starbucks, a Target, you've raised wages. A number of other companies, just because there aren't enough bodies. And people who used to get hired who were perhaps not here fully legally, that labor pool has gone away. So that's a very sort of the non-legal immigrants tend to be a cash business. So we're not seeing that in the data. And they tend to be low-wage workers taking jobs that Americans don't want to wash dishes or pick tomatoes or any of the other.
Or work in Trump's kitchens.
Right. So you end up with that hasn't had a wage impact, hasn't had an inflation impact either officially or unofficially. But when we look at the tariffs and we look at – so we've seen some wages go up on the low end. We've seen the unemployment rate went up, but for the right reasons, more people coming back into the labor force. We like that. On the high end, you've seen the STEM jobs, science, technology, engineering, math, and of course anything involving technology, coding, software, whatever. But those have consistently been well-paying jobs with good benefits and stock options and what have you, but those continue to rise. When you see the rent costs in places like San Francisco, that's just telling you the tech world is booming, and until the tech world stops booming, those rents are going to continue to stay high. So it's very regional. It depends on the industry. It depends on the region. It depends on your education level, how much your wages are going up. But now we're starting to see so that's not a big inflationary issue, wages. But when we look at commodities, what is half the cost of cars, metals? We're selling 16, 17 million cars a year and exporting a bunch and importing a bunch. That's potentially problematic. You look at what happened with Harley-Davidson. You look at some of the appliance companies. So Whirlpool and who else said something? GM basically had decent numbers, but said prospectively we see this see this as a problem. This is going to affect our sales. This is going to affect our profits. The tariffs are really problematic for us. So you end up with, if you want to call it self-inflicted wounds or unforced error, that's before we get to this insanity of using a depression-era law to send $12 billion to farmers. How about this? Let's not have a trade war. I know that's a radical view. I know that's crazy. But it seems ridiculous to say, all right, we're going to have an $18 billion export tariff and we're going to give you $12 billion of it. Why are the taxpayers funding tariffs for one sector, just farm sector? What about the manufacturers? What about the people who are writing software? What about Apple And that sector that's going to suffer from these tariffs, it just seems that, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I know everybody in the White House seems to think that the United States is on the losing end of the world trade. When you break that down in specific details, that's true for people with less education, less skills in certain geographies in the country, in certain industries. So maybe rather than take $12 billion and give it to farmers, which essentially is you're giving it to China, why don't we do what smart countries around the world like Germany have done and say for the people that global international trade, which has helped keep global peace and helped boost the economy around the world, let's do what they do and train these people to get the skills to get into better paying jobs. If you used to make socks at a mill in North Carolina, I'm sorry, but that's a very low cost industry that's moved elsewhere.
Yet Americans are not very good at having that conversation.
Well, it depends. Do we want to be realistic and do we want to be adults, or do we just want to yell at our perceived enemies?
It's way easier to do that.
Or our allies. Yeah, but it's easy to do that until inflation comes up and the Fed tightens and we have a recession. Wholly unforced error.
So, and the unforced error, I'm guessing if you went to Masters of Business, that would be one of the things that they would say that they would try to avoid are unforced errors.
You know, I don't ask that question. I ask, you know, who are your mentors? What are you reading? Tell us your favorite books. What's the thing that most people don't know about you but should? Like questions like that. This is such a specific question to such a specific set of policy things. It's shocking. And, you know, the outrage cycle has just exhausted everybody. So you're not getting the intelligent debate. You know, I used to call myself a Jacob Javits Republican. Growing up in New York, here's a guy who was against the war in Vietnam, was against unfunded spending, and that includes entitlements and tax cuts, but believed the government shouldn't be in the bedroom. The government had no business saying who could get married, whether you can use birth control, abortion rights, etc. And I thought, oh, that makes a lot of sense. And around 20 years ago, the Republicans just made a hard tack to the right and left rationality behind. And it took a long time for a lot of mainstream Republicans to sort of bolt. You look at guys like Rick Wilson or Bill Kristol at the NRO. They are National Review. They're Reagan Republicans.
Yep.
They're not Trump Republicans.
Totally.
And under Bush, you had people like Bruce Bartlett, who was in the Reagan administration and the Bush administration, saying, I don't recognize the Republican Party. And a lot of people thought, come on, Bruce, you're exaggerating a little bit. Turns out he was right, and he identified a schism before the cracks were visible and the house started to fall apart. The adults in charge of the Republican Party just can't seem to bring themselves about to saying, we're the party of free trade, we're the party of non-government intervention. What is all this mania?
Neither of those things.
So I don't recognize this Republican Party. And their affiliation, the party affiliation, was 28-29% pre-Trump. I don't know what happens post-Trump. Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the entire former Reagan Democrats moved to the Republican Party. But it looks like poorly thought out economic policies could lead to very, very significant damage. I still think that's a low probability event. I still think the adults are gonna take charge, but it's a non-zero event. It's, I don't know, 20, 25, 30% possibility that this gets bad and spirals out of control and gets worse. That's a happy note.
Happy note. Back to portfolio management.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that changing?
The rise of quants has been a huge, huge element that evidence-based investing, rules-driven portfolios, things along those lines where it's not, I'm scratching my chin and saying, I think we need a little more semiconductor in this. That stuff is gone to a large degree the way of the dodo, and now we're, you know, the fact that you can make an argument and say, here's what the data shows, here's what the evidence shows, and here's what we think takes place over long periods of time. The fascinating aspect of the reflexivity of markets is whatever works currently is likely to eventually stop working because...
Isn't that a wonderful thing?
Yeah, it never ends.
It means it changes.
Right, it's constantly... So you have to be
aware...
So you got
to be on your toes. Yeah.
Yeah, you have to be aware of what used to work that's not working anymore, and is this temporary, mm-hmm. like value temporary being out of favor, or do the steam belt and leather... Steam engine and leather belt companies, is this a permanent sayonara? And so that's a judgment call, and you have to be pretty reasonable to figure that out. So that's a big change. The concept of, are you really active? Are you really passive? Are they mutually exclusive? Can you be, you know, two-thirds passive, one-third active? I think that's an interesting discussion. And, you know, I'm fond of saying if you can come up with a defendable thesis for why you want to have some percentage of your portfolio in an actively managed, non-representative holding, I don't have a problem with it. We have certain clients who are young and want a very aggressive, active strategy. And we don't like paying hedge fund fees, and same with venture capital. So we found the only outside manager we use has a micro-cap fund that seems to parallel venture capital investing without the lockup, without the 2 and 20.
Who is that?
James O'Shaughnessy. Oh, Sam. Yeah. So that might... Now, the problem is it doesn't scale. You can't put $1 billion into it. But if you have someone...
But it gives you that exposure.
Right. But if somebody wants... Well, you can't because there's only so many micro caps
in
the world.
Right.
On the other hand, if someone has, you know, $5 million and wants to put $500,000 into something that is wildly volatile and but is going to scream when the market goes higher... It's one of those. We work with an outside manager for municipal bonds. We work with an outside manager for just that. And
it's a certain kind of drug.
Right. We don't have the expertise in that.
Yep.
O'Shaughnessy's stuff is great. Go read What Works on Wall Street is one of those seminal books that really is amazing. I'm not like a proselytizer. I'm not one of these people who says, no, never own anything active. Hey, our tactical portfolio has to be considered active. It's evidence-based. It's rules-driven. It's done well, but it's not passive. You can't say that's a passive holding. But there has to be, to us, if that's the emotional steam valve that allows people to leave their main portfolio alone during a market crash, then it served its purpose. But, you know, we don't want to find ourselves rationalizing things constantly. We don't want to find ourselves making excuses. We try and think it through beforehand, and that's when you add that sort of holding. I think that there's going to be more of that in portfolio management. I think rather than just saying this is the mad pursuit of alpha, it's going to be something closer to how does this particular holding help you reach your long-term goals?
Mm-hmm.
That's a very different conversation than I think X fund is going to outperform the S&P 500. Well, what's your track record in picking X funds? How is it done? Why should I think you have the ability to do that? So there's a funny story about this. Most people can't pick stocks, so they hire somebody to be their stock picker. But most stock pickers can't pick stocks.
So you pick an octopus.
So you're right. You're hiring somebody else to hire the person who's going to pick stocks. And you get that like recursive fractal. So you're hiring a person to hire the person to hire the person to pick the stock.
And they take your money and they take your money and they take your money.
It simply doesn't work. And once you build in the cost structure over long periods of time, it's a losing bet. A, you can't find those people. B, finding the people who are worth it beyond their fee structure. I'll give you another active fund that I think is kind of fascinating. Joel Greenblatt, who ran Gatham Capital and put up insane numbers in the 90s, 50% a year for 10 years. That's just insane. So he came up with a quantitative way to look at the S&P 500. You want to own an index? Here's what we're going to do. We're going to own the S&P 500. Then we're going to run our own quantitative screen through this. And we're going to add a big slug of the best stocks in this index long. So now we're like 140%. I'm making up the number. 140% long. Now we're going to run a similar screen, and we're going to find the worst stocks. And we're going to be short that. So you're long the S&P 500 and then balanced long short, long the best, short the worst. In theory, if that works, the next time the market crashes, you'll do much better than the average index.
But the beauty of
that— So you could rationalize that a little bit.
You can package that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And he has a 3-year track record now, which is so that's the sort of—
What's that ticker?
I don't remember the GINDX. I think it's called Index Plus. I may be getting the ticker wrong, but it's Joel Greenblatt Index Plus.
So what's incredible to me about how ETFs have sort of changed investing is that thing that you just described,
right,
that is out there.
Right.
And the dude who used to put up massive returns, like, that guy can't do that anymore because there's this other ETF that can do it for you.
Well, I don't know if he can't do that anymore. I think he, after you've run a fund like that, by the way, Gotham at 50% a year, I want to say about halfway through its run, like Renaissance Technologies said to the outside investors,
"See ya.
Hey, thanks for everything, but you're all a pain in the ass. I'm going to just manage my own money and continue to put up killer numbers."
Okay, so speaking of managing your own money,
mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that?
I eat my own cooking, my own 401k,
all of it,
and
right?
My own portfolio, and
all your
my
guys
wife's,
do, right?
Everybody in the firm invests in our own 401. Our 401ks are in our portfolio. Our personal investments are in our own portfolio. Anybody who doesn't do that, I would never even remotely consider giving my money to. And when someone says to me, well, I want to remain objective, you still have market exposure. You're not trading individual stocks. It's a broad allocation. What do you care? So I 100%. Every single person in our firm, our entire 401k, although I think it was Rick Edelman said in my pantheon of name dropping, said, I'm deeply invested in speculative small cap company, meaning his own company. So there's that also. If I had to pick my single biggest holding, it would have to be me and my partners own the firm. We're employee owned. So eventually everybody in the firm will have an opportunity to be an owner, but we all 100% eat our own cooking. I don't see how you can run an asset management shop and not.
So I'm going to retitle the conversations with you, The World According to Barry Ritholtz, but I'm going to ask a question
okay.
off of that, which is, having talked about a lot of things, what is the world of investing according to Barry Ritholtz?
I think investing is really misunderstood. It's weird. I was such a critic of Wall Street and Bailout Nation that I find myself defending Wall Street. Bogle recently said finance subtracts value. And I don't think that's true. We all carry these powerful little computers in our pockets called mobile phones. That company doesn't come public without Wall Street. When you look at the financing of bridges and tunnels and highways, back when America used to build bridges and tunnels and highways, Wall Street has done that. The problem is that we took was essentially a support industry for the rest of the country and turned it into a main industry. Wall Street should exist to service everybody else. It should provide the ability for small companies to go public. It should provide the ability for mom and pop to make investments in the long term, be it their kids' college or retirement or what have you. And the entire universe of complexity and opaqueness and a high expense should really be replaced. And by the way, complexity and opaqueness, it's not a bug. It's a feature that mm-hmm. it's high cost.
Mm-hmm.
Opaqueness and complexity hides the cost. It should be much more simple and much more transparent and much more lower cost. That process, while long overdue, is finally happening. Vanguard occupied the niche of low cost. The impact of Vanguard has affected everybody. And I think that finance 25 or 50 years from now is going to go back to that service industry that supports the rest of the economy as opposed to the tail wagging the dog. And so there's still lots of things that I think finance does wrong, mm-hmm. and there are lots of products that shouldn't be sold, and there are lots of behaviors and lots
of
rules
that probably shouldn't be
right?
made. Yeah.
But overall, it turns out that this capitalism thing works, that when Vanguard rolls out a cheaper product that does the same thing, only it's better, eventually the market play. You know, I've described Gene Fama and EMH. I have a 05 post called "The Mostly Kinda Sorta Eventually Efficient Market." And eventually markets get it right. It's wrong for long, could be wrong for long periods of time. Eventually competition drives price down. Eventually, look, we had a wrongly regulated market until the early 70s when the constraints on commissions dropped. Stop and think about, wait, you could do a trade for $75 and that's considered cheap? That mm-hmm. that was 40 years ago. Now it's free or insignificant, $8. That competitive factor is driving things in towards the benefit for investors. We're not there yet. We have a way to go, but you have to be unless you're losing half your revenue because of companies like Vanguard and BlackRock and State Street and DFA and go down the list that are providing a service at a lower cost, at a higher quality. You have to like the direction this is moving towards the investors' favor. What began as Bogle's folly has expanded, and we're, I don't know, maybe we're in the third or fourth inning of that set of changes. I could be completely wrong, but I like the direction it's going.
So what haven't we asked you that we should have asked you?
My favorite books, who my mentors were. I don't want to answer those questions.
I'm not going to go down that.
I ask those questions
right.
every week. So, I don't know. We have been really narrow and trying to stay. And I know that's difficult with me.
You've been great, man. It's a little bit like a river. You know, we're just going to go
right.
with the current.
Just
and then
go with the flow.
Go into the right. weeds and then come out of the weeds.
To me, the most interesting change that's taking place is how the millennial generation thinks about money. And I think my observations working with a lot of young people in my office and just you can't help but rub shoulders with millennials in Manhattan, they're far less materialistic than previous generations, although that whole concept of experiences versus materialism, they're brutally blunt and honest. It's very different than you know, you have a conversation about money with a millennial and you say, well, here's the math about small cap and value. And they're like, prove it. Like they show me. They don't want to take your word for anything. They want to see it. Like I walk around with a couple of bucks in cash in my pocket. They like I pull money out and it's like, what's that? Paying for lunch. Pull out a 20. Why wouldn't you use a card? Well, you know, it's yeah.
Or a phone.
Right? That's even the next generation. It's, well, on my card, I get points. I get this. I get that. I don't have to walk around with cash. I know I have a record of everything I've done. Why would you use cash? And I had to stop and say, habit. There's no good reason to use cash.
So, but one of the things that, you know, everybody talks a lot about millennials, but like one of the things that I don't think gets talked about that
but
much.
But nobody wants to do anything about it. It's like the weather.
But here's the thing, though. It's like, how are they going to change?
I don't know. I mean,
they were dealt a bad hand. Yeah.
They were dealt a bad hand. They graduated into a terrible recession. A disproportionate number are still living at home to save money. That's, you know, those become seminal experiences that sometimes shape your views. So if you remember or read about the post-depression generation, they never used debt. They paid cash for everything. There was no credit cards. There was no loans. Maybe they took a mortgage on the house and then had a mortgage burning party mm-hmm. when they paid it off, usually early. Very different headspace with this generation.
And yet that generation created the boomers.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, the pendulum swings this way and then it goes too far in the opposite direction. It swings that way. And that's a continual set of headaches. There's no getting away from that.
All right, I'm going to wrap it up with my last question.
Okay.
Favorite ETF ticker?
Favorite ETF ticker? I don't believe weed is not a pot ETF. That has to be. There was one I heard about some time ago, but it did not come to fruition. Warm for global warming ticker. And then there was she is kind of an interesting ticker.
She's
although it hasn't attracted assets outside of the CalSTRS.
Yeah.
Main funder of it got that
massive inflow at the beginning, and then it just kind of sat there.
It's so, you know, I mentioned in the beginning the behavioral economics and how important that is to not only manage your own emotions but your own behavior. There's something fascinating about either stocks or funds that have a memorable ticker, and I hate to say this because it's so irrational, but if you don't have a really good ticker like SPY or QQQ, which turned out to be a really good ticker, you're starting as an ETF with, you know, you got a 30-pound
totally
pack on your back and you're running up a mountain.
It's real estate.
Because it's memorable. There's a whole narrative aspect that humans love stories, not data. And so if you could tell a really good story about something, it resonates, it's memorable, it rationalizes the decision. And a ticker that follows that narrative story is the cherry on top of the sundae. And it's I hate to say we go through all this math and all this thinking about diversification and how do we keep our costs low and how do we make sure people's behavior is good and blah, blah, blah. And then it's like, but if you could tell a good story and have a good ticker, all that stuff goes out the window.
Yep.
And that is really human investing in a nutshell.
Barry Rareholtz, thank you so much.
Thank you guys for having me. This has been great.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. He's at Ritholtz, RITHOLTZ. I'm at Joel Weber Show. Eric's at Eric Balchus. Trillions is produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.